He grins. Birds fall dead off telephone lines. When he looks at you a certain way, your prostate goes bad and your urine burns. The grass yellows up and dies where he spits. He's always outside. He came out of time. He doesn't know himself. He has the name of 1,000 demons. Jesus knocked him into a herd of pigs once. His name is Legion. He's afraid of us. We're inside. He knows magic. He can call the wolves and live in the crows. He's the king of nowhere. But he's afraid of us. He's afraid of inside. Tom fell silent. The three of them stared at each other, pallid as gravestones. Ralph had seized his hat from his head and was kneading it convulsively in his hands. Nick had put one hand over his eyes. Stu's throat had turned to dry glass. His name is Legion. He is the king of nowhere. "Can you say anything else about him?" Stu asked in a low voice.
"Only that I'm afraid of him, too. But I'll do what you want. But Tom is so afraid."
That dreadful sigh again.
"Tom," Ralph said suddenly, "do you know if Mother Abigail, if she's still alive?"
Ralph's face was desperately set, the face of a man who has staked everything on one turn of the cards.
"She's alive."
Ralph leaned against the back of his chair with a great gust of breath.
"But she's not right with God yet," Tom added.
"Not right with God? Why not, Tommy?"
"She's in the wilderness. God has lifted her up in the wilderness. She does not fear the terror that flies at noon or the terror that creeps at midnight. Neither will the snake bite her nor the bee sting her. But she's not right with God yet. It was not the hand of Moses that brought water from the rock. It was not the hand of Abigail that turned the weasels back with their bellies empty. She's to be pitied. She will see, but she will see too late. There will be death. His death. She will die on the wrong side of the river. She—"
"Oh, stop him," Ralph groaned. "Can't you stop him?"
"Tom," Stu said.
"Yes?"
"Are you the same Tom that Nick met in Oklahoma? Are you the same Tom we know when you're awake?"
"Yes, but I am more than that Tom."
"I don't understand."
He shifted a little, his sleeping face calm.
"I am God's Tom."
Completely unnerved now, Stu almost dropped Nick's notes.
"You say you'll do what we want?"
"Yes."
"But do you see, do you think you'll come back?"
"That's not for me to see or say. Where shall I go?"
"West, Tom." Tom moaned. It was a sound that made the hair on the nape of Stu's neck stand on end.
What are we sending him into?
And maybe he knew. Maybe he had been there himself, only in Vermont, in mazes of corridors where the echo made it seem as if footsteps were following him. And gaining.
"West," Tom said.
"West, yes."
"We're sending you to look, Tom, to look and see, then to come back."
"Come back and tell."
"Can you do that?"
"Yes, unless they catch and kill me."
Stu winced. They all winced.
"You go by yourself, Tom, always west. Can you find west?"
"Where the sun goes down."
"Yes, and if anyone asks why you're there, this is what you'll say. They drove you out of the free zone."
"Drove me out. Drove Tom out. Put him on the road."
"Because you were feeble-minded."
"They drove Tom out because Tom is feeble-minded."
"And because you might have a woman and the woman might have idiot children."
"Idiot children like Tom."
Stu's stomach was rolling back and forth helplessly. His head felt like iron that had learned how to sweat. It was as if he was suffering from a terrible, debilitating hangover. "Now repeat what you'll say if someone asks why you're in the West."
"They drove Tom out because he was feeble-minded. Laws, yes. They were afraid I might have a woman the way you have them with your prick in bed, make her pregnant with idiots."
"That's right, Tom, that's
drove me out," he said in a soft, grieving voice. "Drove Tom out of his nice house and put his feet on the road."
Stu passed a shaking hand over his eyes. He looked at Nick. Nick seemed to double and treble in his vision.
"Nick, I don't know as I can finish," he said helplessly.
Nick looked at Ralph. Ralph, pale as cheese, could only shake his head.
"Finish," Tom said unexpectedly. "Don't leave me out here in the dark."
Forcing himself, Stu went on.
"Tom, do you know what the full moon looks like?"
"Yes, big and round."
"Not the half moon or even most of the moon?"
"No," Tom said.
"When you see that big round moon, you'll come back east, back to us, back to your house, Tom."
"Yes, when I see it, I'll come back," Tom agreed. "I'll come back home."
"And when you come back, you walk in the night and sleep in the day."
"Walk at night, sleep in the day."
"Right, and you won't let anybody see you if you can help it."
"No."
"But Tom, someone might see you."
"Yes, someone might."
"If it's one person that sees you, Tom, kill him."
"Kill him,"
Tom said doubtfully. "If it's more than one, run."
"Run,"
Tom said, with more certainty. "But try not to be seen at all. Can you repeat all that back?"
"Yes. Come back when the moon is full. Not the half moon, not the fingernail moon. Walk at night, sleep in the day. Don't let anybody see me. If one person sees me, kill him. If more than one person sees me, run away. But try not to let anyone see me."
"That's very good. I want you to wake up in a few seconds, okay?"
"Okay."
"When I ask about the elephant, you'll wake up, okay?"
"Okay."
Stu sat back with a long, shuddery sigh.
"Oh, thank God that's over."
Nick agreed with his eyes.
"Did you know that might happen, Nick?"
Nick shook his head.
"How could he know those things?" Stu muttered.
Nick was motioning for his pad. Stu gave it to him, glad to be rid of it. His fingers had sweated the page with Nick's script written on it almost to transparency. Nick wrote and handed it to Ralph. Ralph read it, lips moving slowly, and then handed it to Stu. "Some people through history have considered the insane and the retarded to be close to divine. I don't think he told us anything that can be of practical use to us, but I know he scared the hell out of me."
"Magic," he said. "How do you fight magic?"
"It's all over my head, that's all," Ralph muttered. "Those things he said about Mother Abigail, I don't even want to think about them. Wake him up, Stu, and let's get out of here as quick as we can."
Ralph was close to tears. Stu leaned forward again.
"Tom?"
"Yes?"
"Would you like to see an elephant?"
Tom's eyes opened at once, and he looked around at them.
"I told you it wouldn't work," he said. "Laws, no, Tom doesn't get sleepy in the middle of the day."
Nick handed a sheet to Stu, who glanced at it and then spoke to Tom. "Nick says you did just fine."
"I did? Did I stand on my head like before?"
With a twinge of bitter shame, Nick thought, "No, Tom, you did a bunch of even better tricks this time."
"No," Stu said.
"Tom, we came to ask if you could help us."
"Me? Help? Sure, I love to help."
"This is dangerous, Tom. We want you to go west and then come back and tell us what you saw."
"Okay, sure,"
Tom said without the slightest hesitation, but Stu thought he saw a momentary shadow cross Tom's face and linger behind his guileless blue eyes.
"When?"
Stu put a gentle hand on Tom's neck and wondered just what in the hell he was doing here. How were you supposed to figure these things out if you weren't Mother Abigail and didn't have a hotline to heaven?
Pretty soon now, he said gently. Pretty soon. When Stu got back to the apartment, Franny was fixing supper.
Harold was over, she said. I asked him to stay to dinner, but he begged off.
Oh.
She looked more closely at him.
Stuart Redman, what dog bit you?
A dog named Tom Cullen, I guess. And he told her everything. They sat down to dinner.
What does it all mean? Fran asked.
Her face was pale, and she was not really eating, only pushing her food from one side of her plate to the other.
Damned if I know, Stu said. It's a kind of seeing, I guess. I don't know why we should balk at the idea of Tom Cullen having visions while he's under hypnosis, not after the dreams we all had on our way here. If they weren't a kind of seeing, I don't know what they were.
But they seem so long ago now, or at least they do to me.
Yeah, to me too, Stu agreed, and realized he was pushing his own food around.
Look, Stu, I know we agreed not to talk about committee business outside the committee's meetings if we could help it. You said we'd be wrangling all the time, and you were probably right. I haven't said word one about you turning into Marshall Dillon after the 25th, have I?
He smiled briefly.
No, you haven't, Franny.
But I have to ask if you still think sending Tom Cullen West is a good idea, after what happened this afternoon.
I don't know, Stu said. He pushed his plate away. Most of the food on it was untouched. He got up, went to the hall dresser, and found a pack of cigarettes. He had cut his consumption to 3 or 4 a day. He lit this one, drew harsh, stale tobacco smoke deep into his lungs, and blew it out.
On the positive side, his story is simple enough and believable enough. We drove him out because he's a halfwit. Nobody is going to be able to shake him from that. And if he gets back okay, we can hypnotize him. He goes under in the time it takes you to snap your fingers, for the Lord's sake. And he'll tell us everything he's seen, the important things and the unimportant things. It's possible that he'll turn out to be a better eyewitness than either of the others. I don't doubt that.
If he gets back okay.
Yeah, if. We gave him an instruction to travel east only at night and to hide up in the day. If he sees more than one person, to run. But if he was seen by one person only, to kill him.
Stu, you didn't.
Of course we did, he said angrily, wheeling on her. We're not playing pat a cake here, Franny. You must know what's going to happen to him, or the judge, or Dana, if they get caught over there. Why else were you so set against the idea in the first place?
Okay, she said quietly. Okay, Stu.
No, it's not okay, he said, and slammed the freshly lit cigarette down into a pottery ashtray, sending up a little cloud of sparks. Several of them landed on the back of his hand, and he brushed them off with a quick, savage gesture. It's not okay to send a feeble kid out to fight our battles. And it's not okay to push people around like pawns on a fucking chessboard, and it's not okay giving orders to kill like a mafia boss. But I don't know what else we can do. I just don't know. If we don't find out what he's up to, there's a damn fine chance that someday next spring he may turn the whole free zone into one big mushroom cloud.
Okay. Hey, okay.
He clenched his fists slowly.
I was shouting at you. I'm sorry. I had no right to do that, Fran.
It's all right. You weren't the one who opened Pandora's box.
We're all opening it, I guess, he said dully, and got another cigarette from the pack in the dresser.
Anyhow, when I gave him that, what do you call it, when I said he should kill any person that got in his way, a kind of frown came over his face. It was gone right away. I don't even know if Ralph or Nick saw it, but I did. It was like he was thinking, okay, I understand what you mean, but I'll make up my own mind on that when the time comes.
I've read that you can't hypnotize someone into doing something they wouldn't do when they were awake. A person won't go against his own moral code just because they're told to do it when they're under.
Stu nodded. Yeah, I was thinking of that. But what if this fellow Flag has got a line of pickets strung down the whole eastern length of his border? I would if I were him. If Tom runs into that picket line going west, he's got his story to cover him, but if he's coming back east and runs into them, it's going to be kill or get killed. And if Tom won't kill, he's apt to be a dead duck.
You may be too worried about that one part of it, Franny said.
I mean, if there is a picket line, wouldn't it have to be strung pretty thin?
Yeah, one man every 50 miles, something like that, unless he's got 5 times the people we do.
So unless they've got some pretty sophisticated equipment already set up and running, radar and infrared and all that stuff you see in the spy movies, wouldn't Tom be apt to walk right through them?
Well, that's what we're hoping, but
you've got a bad attack of conscience, she said softly.
Is that what it comes down to?
Well, maybe so.
What did Harold want, honey?
He left a bunch of those survey maps, areas where his search committee has looked for Mother Abigail. Anyhow, Harold's been working on that burial detail as well as supervising the search committee. He looked very tired, but his free zone duties aren't the only reason. He's been working on something else as well, it seems.
What's that?
Harold's got a woman.
Stu raised his eyebrows.
Anyway, that's why he begged off on dinner.
Can you guess who she is?
Stu squinted up at the ceiling.
Now, who could Harold be shacking with? Let me see.
Well, that's a hell of a way to put it. What do you think we're doing?
She threw a mock slap at him, and he drew back, grinning.
Fun, ain't it?
I give up. Who is it?
Nadine Cross. That woman with the white in her hair?
That's her.
Gosh, she must be twice his age.
I doubt, Franny said, that it's a concern to Harold at this point in his relationship.
Does Larry know?
I don't know and care less. The Cross woman isn't Larry's girl now, if she ever was.
Yeah, Stu said.
He was glad Harold had found himself a little love interest, but not terribly interested in the subject. How does Harold feel about the search committee, anyway? Did he give you any idea?
Well, you know Harold. He smiles a lot, but not very hopeful. I guess that's why he's putting in most of his time on the burial detail. They call him Hawk now, did you know that?
Really?
I heard it today. I didn't know who they were talking about until I asked.
She mused for a moment, then laughed.
What's funny? Stu asked.
She stuck out her feet, which were clad in low-topped sneakers. On the soles were patterns of circles and lines.
He complimented me on my sneakers, she said. Isn't that dippy?
You're dippy, Stu said, grinning. Harold woke up just before dawn with a dull but not entirely unpleasant ache in his groin. He shivered a little as he got up. It was getting noticeably colder in the early mornings, although it was only August 22nd, and fall was still a calendar month away. But there was heat below his waist. Oh, yes. Just looking at the delectable curve of her buttocks in those tiny see-through underpants as she slept was warming him up considerably. She wouldn't mind if he woke her up. Well, maybe she would mind, but she wouldn't object. He still had no idea of what might lie behind those dark eyes, and he was a little afraid of her. Instead of waking her up, he dressed quietly. He didn't want to mess around with Nadine as much as he would have liked to. What he needed to do was go someplace alone and think. He paused at the door, fully dressed, carrying his boots in his left hand. Between the slight chilliness of the room and the prosy act of getting dressed, his desire had left him. He could smell the room now, and the smell was not terribly appealing. It was just a little thing, she had said, a thing they could do without. Perhaps it was true. She could do things with her mouth and hands that were nearly beyond belief. But if it was such a small thing, why did this room have that stale and slightly sour odor that he associated with the solitary pleasure of all his bad years? Maybe because you want it to be bad.
Disturbing thought. He went out, closing the door softly behind him. Nadine's eyes opened the moment the door was closed. She sat up, looked thoughtfully at the door, then lay down again. Her body ached in a slow and unrelieved cycle of desire. It felt almost like menstrual cramps. If it was such a small thing, she thought, with no idea of how close to Harold's her own thoughts were, why did she feel this way? At one point last night she'd had to bite her lips together to stifle the cries.
"Stop that fooling around and stick me with that thing! Do you hear me? Stick me with it! Cram me full of it! Do you think what you're doing is doing anything for me? Stick me with it, and let's, for Christ's sake, or mine at least, end this crazy game.
He had been lying with his head between her legs, making strange noises of lust, noises that might have been comic had they not been so honestly urgent, so nearly savage. And she had looked up, those words trembling behind her lips, and had seen, or only thought she had, a face at the window. In an instant the fire of her own lust had been damped down to cold ash. It had been his face, grinning savagely in at her. A scream had risen in her throat, and then the face was gone. The face was nothing but a moving pattern of shadows on the darkened glass, mingled with smudges of dust. No more than the boogeyman a child imagines he sees in the closet, or curled up slyly behind the chest of toys in the corner. No more than that. Except it was more, and not even now, in the first cold rational light of dawn, could she pretend otherwise. It would be dangerous to pretend otherwise. It had been him, and he had been warning her. The husband-to-be was watching over his intended, and the bride defiled would be the bride unaccepted. She stared at the ceiling. She thought, I suck his cock, but that's not defilement. I let him stick himself up my ass, but that isn't defilement either. I dress for him like a cheap street-walking slut, but that's perfectly okay. It was enough to make you wonder what sort of man your fiancé really was. Nadine stared up at the ceiling for a long, long time. Harold made instant coffee, drank it with a grimace, and then took a couple of cold Pop-Tarts out onto the front step. He sat down and ate them while dawn crept across the land. In retrospect, the last couple of days seemed like a mad carnival ride to him. It was a blur of orange trucks, of Wyzak clapping him on the shoulder and calling him Hawk, they all called him that now, of dead bodies, a never-ending moldy stream of them, and then coming home from all that death to a never-ending flow of kinky sex, enough to blur your head. But now, sitting here on a front step as cold as a marble headstone, a horrible cup of instant coffee sloshing in his guts, he could munch these sawdust-tasting cold Pop-Tarts and think. He felt clear-headed, sane after a season of insanity. It occurred to him that, for a person who had always considered himself to be a Cro-Magnon man amid a herd of thundering Neanderthals, he had been doing precious little thinking lately. He had been led, not by the nose, but by the penis. He turned his mind to Franny Goldsmith, even as he turned his gaze out to the Flatirons. It was Franny who had been at his house that day. He knew it for sure now. He had gone over to the place where she lived with Redman on a pretext, really hoping to get a look at her footgear. As it turned out, she had been wearing the sneakers that matched the print he had found on his cellar floor. Circles and lines instead of the usual waffle or zigzag tread. No question, baby. He thought he could put it together without too much trouble. Somehow she had found out he had read her diary. He must have left a smudge or mark on one of the pages, maybe more than one. So she had come to his house looking for some indication of how he felt about what he had read, something written down. There was, of course, his ledger, but she hadn't found it. He could feel positive of that. His ledger said flat out that he planned to kill Stuart Redman. If she had found something like that, she would have told Stu. Even if she hadn't, he didn't believe she could have been as easy and as natural with him as she had been yesterday. He finished his last Pop-Tart, grimacing at the taste of its cold frosting and colder jelly center. He decided he would walk to the bus station instead of taking his cycle. Teddy Wyzak or Norris could drop him off on the way home. He set off, zipping his light jacket all the way to his chin against the chill that would be gone in an hour or so. He walked past the empty houses with their shades drawn, and about 6 blocks down Arapahoe he began to see an X mark chalked boldly on door after door. Again, his idea. The burial committee had checked all those houses where the mark appeared, and had hauled away whatever bodies were to be hauled away. X, a crossing out. The people who had lived in those houses where the mark appeared were gone for all time. In another month, that X mark would be all over Boulder, signifying the end of an age. It was time to think, and to think carefully. It seemed that since he had met Nadine, he really had stopped thinking, but maybe he had really stopped even before that. I read her diary because I was hurt and jealous, he thought. Then she broke into my house, probably looking for my own diary, but she didn't find it. But just the shock of someone breaking in had maybe been revenge enough. It had certainly bent him out of shape. Maybe they were even, and it could be quits. He didn't really want Franny anymore, did he? Did he? He felt the sullen coal of resentment glow in his chest. Maybe not. But that didn't change the fact that they had excluded him. Although Nadine had said little about her reasons for coming to him, Harold had an idea that she had been excluded in some way too, rebuffed, turned back. They were a couple of outsiders, and outsiders hatch plots. It's perhaps the only thing that keeps them sane. Remember to put that in the ledger, Harold thought. He was almost downtown now. There was a whole company of outsiders on the other side of the mountains. And when there are enough outsiders together in one place, a mystic osmosis takes place and you're inside. Inside, where it's warm. Just a little thing, being inside where it's warm, but really such a big thing. About the most important thing in the world. Maybe he didn't want to be quits and even. Maybe he didn't want to settle for a draw, for a career of riding in a 20th century dead cart and getting meaningless letters of thanks for his ideas and waiting 5 years for Bateman to retire from their precious committee so he could be on it. And what if they decided to pass over him again? They might, too, because it wasn't just a question of age. They had taken the goddamn deaf mute and he was only a few years older than Harold himself. The coal of resentment was burning brightly now. Think, sure, think. That was easy to say, and sometimes it was even easy to do. But what good was thinking when all it got you from the Neanderthals who ran the world was a horse laugh, or even worse, a thank you letter? He reached the bus station. It was still early, and no one was there yet. There was a poster on the door saying there was going to be another public meeting on the 25th. Public meeting? Public circle, jerk. The waiting room was festooned with travel posters and ads for the Greyhound Ameripass and pictures of Big Mother humping scenic cruisers rolling through Atlanta, New Orleans, San Francisco, Nashville, wherever. He sat down and stared with a cold morning eye at the darkened pinball machines, the Coke machine, the coffee machine that would also dispense a Lipton cup of soup that smelled vaguely like a dead fish. He lit a cigarette and threw the match stub on the floor. They had adopted the Constitution. Whoopee! How very, very and tutu. They had even sung the Star Speckled Banana, for Christ's sweet sake. But suppose Harold Lauder had gotten up, not to make a few constructive suggestions, but to tell them the facts of life in this first year after the plague. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Harold Emery Lauder, and I'm here to tell you that, in the words of the old song, the fundamental things apply as time goes by. Like Darwin. The next time you stand and sing the national anthem, friends and neighbors, chew on this. America is dead, dead as a doornail, dead as Jacob Marley and Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Harry S. Truman. But the principles just propounded by Mr. Darwin are still very much alive as Jacob Marley's ghost was to Ebenezer Scrooge. While you are meditating on the beauties of constitutional rule, spare a little time to meditate on Randall Flagg, man of the West. I doubt very much if he has any time to spare for such fripperies as public meetings and ratifications and discussions on the true meaning of a peach in the best liberal mode. Instead, he has been concentrating on the basics, on his Darwin, preparing to wipe the great Formica counter of the universe with your dead bodies. Ladies and gentlemen, let me modestly suggest that while we are trying to get the lights on and waiting for a doctor to find our happy little hive, he may be searching eagerly for someone with a pilot's credentials so he can start overflights of Boulder in the best Francis Gary Powers tradition. While we debate the burning question of who will be on the street cleaning committee, he has probably already seen to the creation of a gun cleaning committee, not to mention mortars, missile sites, and possibly even germ warfare centers. Of course, we know this country doesn't have any germ or biological warfare centers. That's one of the things that makes this country great. What country? Ha ha! But you should realize that while we're busy getting all the wagons in a circle, he's... Hey, Hawk, you pulling overtime? Harold looked up, smiling. "Yeah, I thought I'd get some," he told Wyzak. "I clocked you when I came in. You made $6 already." Wyzak laughed.
"Hey, you're a card hawk, you know that?"
"I am," Harold agreed, still smiling. He began to relace his boots.
"A wild card."
Chapter 56 Stu spent the next day at the power station, wrapping motors, and was cycling home at the end of the workday. He had reached the small park opposite the First National Bank when Ralph hailed him over. He parked his cycle and walked over to the bandshell where Ralph was sitting.
"I've been kinda looking for you, Stu. You got a minute?"
"Just one. I'm late for supper. Franny'll be worried."
"Yeah. Been up to the power station wrapping copper from the look of your hands."
Ralph looked absent and worried.
"Yeah, not even workman's gloves do much good. My hands are wrecked."
Ralph nodded. There were maybe half a dozen other people in the park, some of them looking at the narrow-gauge railway train that had once gone between Boulder and Denver. A trio of young women had spread out a picnic supper. Stu found it very pleasant just to sit here with his wounded hands in his lap. "Maybe marshalling won't be so bad," he thought. "At least it'll get me off that goddamn assembly line in East Boulder."
"How's it going out there?" Ralph asked.
"Me? I wouldn't know. I'm just hired help like the rest. Brad Kitchener says it's going like a house afire. He says the lights will be back on by the end of the first week of September, maybe sooner, and that we'll have heat by the middle of the month. Of course, he's pretty young to be making with the predictions."
"I'll put my money on Brad," Ralph said. "I trust him. He's been getting a lot of what you call on-the-job training."
Ralph tried to laugh. The laugh turned into a sigh, which seemed fetched up from the big man's boot heels.
"Why are you so down at the mouth, Ralph?"
"I got some news on my radio," Ralph said. "Some of it's good, some of it... well, some of it's not so good, Stu. I want you to know because there's no way to keep it secret. Lots of people in the zone with CBs. I imagine some were listening when I was talking to these new folks coming in."
"How many?"
"Over 40. One of them's a doctor named George Richardson. He sounds like a fine man. Level-headed."
"Well, that's great news."
"He's from Derbyshire, Tennessee. Most of the people in this group are sort of mid-southern. Well, it seems they had a pregnant woman with them, and her time came up 10 days ago, on the 13th. This doctor delivered her of them, twins she had, and they were fine. At first they were fine."
Ralph lapsed back into silence, his mouth working. Stu grabbed him.
"They died? The babies died? That what you trying to tell me, that they died? Talk to me, damn it!"
"They died," Ralph said in a low voice. "One of them went in 12 hours. Appeared to just choke to death. The other went 2 days later. Nothing Richardson could do to save them. The woman went loony, raving about death and destruction and no more babies. You want to make sure Fran isn't around when they come in, Stu. That's what I wanted to tell you. And that you should let her know about this right away. Because if you don't, someone else will."
Stu let go of Ralph's shirt slowly.
"This Richardson, he wanted to know how many pregnant women we had, and I said only one that we know of right now. He asked how far along she was, and I said 4 months. Is that right?"
"She's 5 months now. But, Ralph, is he sure those babies died of the superflu? Is he sure?"
"No, he's not, and you gotta tell Franny that, too, so she understands it. He said it could have been in a number of things. The mother's diet, something hereditary, a respiratory infection, or maybe they were just, you know, defective babies. He said it could have been the RH factor, whatever that is. He just couldn't tell, them being born in the middle of a field beside the doggone Interstate 70. He said that him and about 3 others who were in charge of their group sat up late at night and talked it over. Richardson, he told them what it might mean if it was the Captain Trips that killed those babies, and how important it was for them to find out one way or the other for sure."
"Glenn and I talked about that," Stu said bleakly, "the day I met him. July 4th, that was. It seems so long ago.
Anyway, if it was the superflu that killed those babies, it probably means that in 40 or 50 years we can leave the whole shebang to the rats and the houseflies and the sparrows.
I guess that's pretty much what Richardson told them. Anyway, they were some 40 miles west of Chicago, and he persuaded them to turn around the next day so they could take the bodies back to a big hospital where he could do an autopsy. He said he could find out for sure if it was the superflu. He saw enough of it at the end of June. I guess all doctors did.
Yeah. But when the morning came, the babies were gone. That woman had buried them, and she wouldn't say where. They spent 2 days digging, thinking that she couldn't have gone too far away from the camp or buried them too deep, being just over her delivery and all. But they didn't find them, and she wouldn't say where, no matter how much they tried to explain how important it was. Poor woman was just all the way off in her chump.
I can understand that, Stu said, thinking of how much Fran wanted her baby.
The doctor said that even if it was the superflu, maybe 2 immune people can make an immune baby, Ralph said hopefully.
The chances that the natural father of Fran's baby was immune are about 1 in a billion, I guess, Stu said. He sure isn't here.
Yeah, I guess it couldn't hardly be, could it? I'm sorry to have to put this on you, Stu, but I thought you'd better know so you could tell her.
I don't look forward to that, Stu said. But when he got home, he found that someone else had already done it.
Franny?
No answer. Supper was on the stove, burnt on mostly, but the apartment was dark and quiet. Stu came into the living room and looked around. There was an ashtray on the coffee table with 2 cigarette butts in it, but Fran didn't smoke and they weren't his brand.
Babe?
He went into the bedroom and she was there, lying on the bed in the semi-gloom, looking at the ceiling. Her face was puffy and tear-streaked.
Hi, Stu, she said quietly.
Who told you? He asked angrily. Who just couldn't wait to spread the good news? Whoever was, I'll break their damn arm.
It was Sue Stern. She heard it from Jack Jackson. He's got a CB, and he heard that doctor talking with Ralph. She thought she'd better tell me before someone else made a bad job of it. Poor little Franny. Handle with care. Do not open until Christmas.
She uttered a little laugh. There was a desolation in that sound that made Stu feel like crying. He came across the room and lay down beside her on the bed and stroked her hair off her forehead.
Honey, it's not sure. No way that it's sure.
I know it's not. And maybe we could have our own babies even so.
She turned to look up at him, her eyes red-rimmed and unhappy.
But I want this one. Is that so wrong?
No, of course not.
I've been lying here waiting for him to move or something. I've never felt him move since that night Larry came looking for Harold. Remember?
Yes.
I felt the baby move, and I didn't wake you up. Now I wish I had. I sure do.
She began to cry again and put an arm over her face so he wouldn't see her doing it. Stu took the arm away, stretched out beside her, kissed her. She hugged him fiercely, and then lay passively against him. When she spoke, the words were half muffled against his neck.
Not knowing makes it that much worse. Now I have to just wait and see. It seems like such a long time to have to wait and see if your baby is going to die before it's spent a day outside of your body.
You won't be waiting alone, he said.
She hugged him tight again for that, and they lay there together without moving for a long time. Nadine Cross had been in the living room of her old place for almost 5 minutes, gathering things up, before she saw him sitting in the chair in the corner, naked except for his underpants, his thumb in his mouth, his strange gray-green Chinese eyes watching her. She was so startled, as much by the knowledge that he had been sitting there all the time as by the actual sudden sight of him, that her heart took a high, frightened leap in her chest, and she screamed. The paperbacks she had been about to stuff into her pack sack tumbled to the floor in a flutter of pages.
Joe! I mean, Leo!
She put a hand on her chest above the swell of her breasts, as if to quell the crazy beating of her heart. But her heart was not ready to slow yet, hand or no hand.
Catching sudden sight of him was bad. Catching sight of him dressed and acting the way he had been when she had first made his acquaintance in New Hampshire was even worse. It was too much of a return, as if some irrational god had suddenly bundled her viciously through a time warp and condemned her to live the last 6 weeks all over again.
"You scared the dickens out of me," she finished weakly.
Joe said nothing. She walked slowly over to him, half expecting to see a long kitchen knife in one of his hands, as in days of yore. But the hand which was not at his mouth was curled blamelessly in his lap. She saw that his body had been milked of its tan. The old scars and bramble scratches were gone, but the eyes were the same, eyes that could haunt you. Whatever had been in them, a little more each day since he had come to the fire to listen to Larry play the guitar, was now utterly gone. His eyes were as they had been when she first met him, and this filled her with a creeping sort of terror.
"What are you doing here?"
Joe said nothing.
"Why aren't you with Larry and Lucy, Mom?"
No reply.
"You can't stay here," she said, trying to reason with him, but before she could go on, she found herself wondering how long he had already been here.
This was the morning of August 24th. She had spent the previous two nights at Harold's. The thought that he might have been sitting in that chair with his thumb corked securely in his mouth for the last 40 hours came to her. It was a ridiculous idea, of course. He would have to eat and drink, wouldn't he? But once the thought image had come, it would not leave. That sense of creepiness came over her again, and she realized with something like despair how much she herself had changed. Once she had slept fearlessly next to this little savage, at a time when he had been armed and dangerous. Now he was without weapons, but she found herself in terror of him. She had thought, Joe, Leo, his previous self, had been neatly and completely disposed of. Now he was back, and he was here.
"You can't stay here," she said.
"I just came back to get some things. I'm moving out. I'm moving in with a man."
"Oh, is that what Harold is?" some interior voice mocked. "I thought he was just a tool, a means to an end."
"Leo, listen." His head shook, faintly but visibly. His eyes, stern and glittering, fixed upon her face.
"You're not Leo?"
That faint shake came again.
"Are you Joe?"
A nod, just as faint.
"Well, all right, but you have to understand that it really doesn't matter who you are," she said, trying to be patient. That crazy feeling that she was in a time warp, that she was back to square one, persisted. It made her feel unreal and frightened. "That part of our lives, the part where we were together and on our own, that part is gone. You've changed, I've changed, and we can't change back."
But his strange eyes remained fixed upon hers, seeming to deny this.
"And stop staring at me," she snapped. "It's very impolite to stare at people."
Now his eyes seemed to become faintly accusatory. They seemed to suggest that it was also impolite to leave people on their own, and more impolite still, to withdraw one's love from people who still needed and depended on it.
"It's not as if you're on your own," she said, turning and beginning to pick up the books she had dropped.
She knelt clumsily and without grace, her knees popping like firecrackers as she did so. She began to stuff the books into the pack sack willy-nilly, on top of her sanitary napkins and her aspirin and her underthings. Plain cotton underthings, quite different from the ones she wore for Harold's frantic amusement.
"You have Larry and Lucy. You want them and they want you. Well, Larry wants you, and that's all that matters, because she wants all the things he does. She's like a piece of carbon paper. Things are different for me now, Joe, and that's not my fault. That's not my fault at all, so you can just stop trying to guilt-trip me."
She began trying to buckle the pack sack's clasps, but her fingers were trembling uncontrollably, and it was hard to work. The silence grew heavier and heavier around her. At last she stood up, shrugging the pack sack onto her shoulders.
"Leo,"
she tried to speak calmly and reasonably, the way she used to speak to difficult children in her classes when they had tantrums. It just wasn't possible. Her voice was all in jigs and jags, and the little shake of his head which greeted her use of the word Leo made it even worse.
"It wasn't Larry and Lucy," Nadine said viciously. "I could have understood that, if that was all it was. But it was really that old bag you gave me up for, wasn't it? That stupid old woman in her rocking chair grinning at the world with her false teeth. But now she's gone, and so you come running back to me. But it won't play, do you hear me? It won't play."
Joe said nothing.
"And when I begged Larry, got down on my knees and begged him, he couldn't be bothered. He was too busy playing big man. So you see, none of this is my fault, none of it."
The boy only stared at her impassively. Her terror began to return, burying her incoherent rage. She backed away from him to the door and fumbled behind her for the knob. She found it at last, turned it, and jerked the door open. The rush of cool outside air against her shoulders was very welcome.
"Go to Larry," she muttered. "Goodbye, kiddo."
She backed out awkwardly and stood on the top steps for a moment, trying to gather her wits. It suddenly occurred to her that the whole thing might have been a hallucination, brought on by her own guilt feelings. Guilt at abandoning the boy, guilt at making Larry wait too long, guilt at the things she and Harold had done, and the much worse things which were waiting. Perhaps there had been no real boy in that house at all. No more real than the phantasms of Poe, the beating of the old man's heart, sounding like a watch wrapped in cotton, or the raven perched on the bust of Pallas.
"Tapping, ever tapping at my chamber door," she whispered aloud without thinking.
And that made her utter a horrid, croaking little giggle, probably not much different from the sounds ravens actually made. Still, she had to know. She went to the window beside the front steps and looked into the living room of what had once been her house. Not that it had ever been hers, not really. When you lived in a place and all you wanted to take out of it when you left would fit in one pack sack, it had never really been yours to begin with. Looking in, she saw some dead wife's rug and curtains and wallpaper, some dead husband's pipe stand and issues of Sports Illustrated scattered carelessly on the coffee table, pictures of dead children on the mantel, and sitting in the corner chair, some dead woman's little boy clad only in his underpants, sitting, still sitting, sitting as he had sat before. Nadine fled, stumbling, almost falling over the low wire wickets which protected the flower bed to the left of the window where she had looked in. She flung herself onto her Vespa and got it started. She drove with reckless speed for the first few blocks, slaloming in and out of the stalled cars which still littered these side streets, but a little at a time she calmed down. By the time she reached Harold's, she had gotten herself under some kind of control, but she knew it had to end quickly for her here in the zone. If she wanted to keep her sanity, she must soon be away. The meeting at Munsinger Auditorium went well. They began by singing the national anthem again, but this time most of them remained dry-eyed. It was simply a part of what would soon become ritual. A census committee was voted routinely with Sandy Duchenne in charge. She and her four helpers immediately began going through the audience, counting heads, taking names. At the end of the meeting, to the accompaniment of tremendous cheers, she announced that there were now 814 souls in the free zone, and promised, rashly as it turned out, to have a complete directory by the time the next zone meeting was called, a directory she hoped to update week by week, containing names in alphabetical order, ages, Boulder addresses, previous addresses, and previous occupations. As it turned out, the flow into the zone was so heavy and yet so erratic that she was always 2 or 3 weeks behind. The elective period of the Free Zone Committee was brought up, and after some extravagant suggestions, 10 years was one, life was another, and Larry brought down the house by saying they sounded more like prison terms than those of elective office, the yearly term was voted in. Harry Dunbarton's hand waved near the back of the hall, and Stu recognized him. Bellowing to make himself heard, Harry said, "Even a year may be too much. I have nothing at all against the ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I think you're doing a hell of a job." Cheers and whistles. "But this is going to get out of hand before long if we keep getting bigger." Glenn raised his hand, and Stu acknowledged him. "Mr. Chairman, this isn't on the agenda, but I think Mr. Dunbarton there has an excellent point." "I just bet you think he does, Baldy," Stu thought, "since you brought it up a week ago.
I'd like to make a motion that we have a representative government committee so we can really put the Constitution back to work. I think Harry Dunbarton should head that committee, and I'll serve on it myself unless someone thinks I've got a conflict of interest. More cheers. In the last row, Harold turned to Nadine and whispered in her ear, "Ladies and gentlemen, the public love feast is now in session." She gave him a slow, dark smile, and he felt giddy. Stu was elected Free Zone Marshal by roaring acclamation. "I'll do the best I can by you," he said. "Some of you cheering me now may have cause to change your tunes later if I catch you doing something you shouldn't be doing. You hear me, Rich Moffat?" A large roar of laughter. Rich, who was as drunk as a hoot owl, joined in agreeably. "But I don't see any reason why we should have any real trouble here. The main job of a marshal, as I see it, is stopping people from hurting each other. And there aren't any of us who want to do that. Enough people have been hurt already. And I guess that's all I've got to say." The crowd gave him a long ovation. "Now this next item," Stu said, "kind of goes along with the marshalling. We need about 5 people to serve on a law committee, or I'm not going to feel right about locking anyone up, should it come to that. Do I hear any nominations?" "How about the judge?" someone shouted. "Yeah, the judge, damn right," someone else yelled. Heads craned expectantly as people waited for the judge to stand up and accept the responsibility in his usual rococo style. A whisper ran around the hall as people retold the story of how he had put a pin in the Flying Saucer Nuts balloon. Agendas were put down as people prepared to clap. Stu's eyes met Glenn's with mutual chagrin. Someone on the committee should have foreseen this. "Ain't here," someone said. "Who's seen him?" Lucy Swan asked, upset. Larry glanced at her uncomfortably, but she was still looking around the hall for the judge. "I seen him." A mutter of interest as Teddy Wyzak stood up about 3/4 of the way back in the auditorium, looking nervous and polishing his steel-rimmed spectacles compulsively with his bandana.
"Where?"
"Where was he, Teddy?" "Was it in town? What was he doing?" Teddy Wyzak flinched visibly from this barrage of questions. Stu pounded his gavel.
"Come on, folks, order."
"I seen him 2 days ago," Teddy said. "He had himself a Land Rover. Said he was going to Denver for the day. Didn't say why. We had a joke or two about it. He seemed in real good spirits. That's all I know." He sat down, still polishing his spectacles and blushing furiously. Stu rapped for order again. "I'm sorry the judge isn't here. I think he would have been just the man for the job. But since he isn't, could we have another nomination?"
"No, let's not leave it at that," Lucy protested, getting to her feet.
She was wearing a snug denim jumpsuit that brought interested looks to the faces of most of the males in the audience.
"Judge Ferris is an old man. What if he got sick in Denver and can't get back?"
"Lucy," Stu said, "Denver's a big place." An odd silence fell over the meeting hall as people considered this. Lucy sat down, looking pale, and Larry put his arm around her. His eyes met Stu's, and Stu looked away. A half-hearted motion was made to table the law committee until the judge got back, and was voted down after 20 minutes of discussion. They had another lawyer, a young man of about 26 named Al Bundell, who had come in late that afternoon with the Dr. Richardson party, and he accepted the chairmanship when it was offered, saying only that he hoped no one would do anything too terrible in the next month or so, because it would take at least that long to work out some sort of rotating tribunal system. Judge Ferris was voted a place on the committee in absentia. Brad Kitchener, looking pale, fidgety, and a little ridiculous in a suit and tie, approached the podium, dropped his prepared remarks, picked them up in the wrong order, and contented himself by saying they hoped and expected to have the electricity back on by the 2nd or 3rd of September. This remark was greeted with such a storm of cheering that he gained enough confidence to finish in style and actually strut a little as he left the podium. Chad Norris was next, and Stu told Franny later that he had approached the thing in just the right way. They were burying the dead out of common decency. None of them would feel really good until that was done and life could go on, and if it was finished by the fall rainy season, they would all feel so much the better. He asked for a couple of volunteers and could have had 36 if he wanted them. He finished by asking each member of the current spade squad, as he called them, to stand and take a bow.
Harold Lauder barely popped up and then sat back down again, and there were those who left the meeting remarking on what a smart but very modest fellow he was. Actually, Nadine had been whispering things in his ear, and he was afraid to do much more than bob and nod. A fairly large pup tent appeared to have been erected in the crotch of his pants. When Norris left the podium, Ralph Brentner took his place. He told them that they at last had a doctor. George Richardson stood up to loud applause. Richardson flipped the peace sign with both hands, and the applause turned to cheers. And then told them that as far as he could tell, they had another 60 people joining them over the next couple of days. "Well, that's the agenda," Stu said. He looked out over the gathered people. "I want Sandy Duchenne to come up here again and tell us how many we are, but before I do that, is there other business we should take up tonight?" He waited. He could see Glenn's face in the crowd, and Sue Stern's, Larry's, Nick's, and, of course, Franny's. They all looked a bit strained. If someone was going to bring up Flagg, ask what the committee was doing about him, this would be the time. But there was silence. After 15 seconds of it, Stu turned the meeting over to Sandy, who ended things in style. As people began to file out, Stu thought, "Well, we got by it again." Several people came up to congratulate him after the meeting, one of them the new doctor.
"You handled that very well, Marshal," Richardson said, and for a moment Stu almost looked over his shoulder to see who Richardson was talking to.
Then he remembered and suddenly felt scared. Lawman? He was an imposter. "A year," he told himself, "a year and no more." But he still felt scared. Stu, Fran, Sue Stern, and Nick walked back toward the center of town together, their feet clicking hollowly on the cement sidewalk as they crossed the CU campus toward Broadway. Around them, other people were streaming away, talking quietly, headed home. It was nearly 11:30.
"It's chilly," Fran said. "I wish I'd worn my jacket as well as this sweater."
Nick nodded. He also felt the chill. The Boulder evenings were always cool, but tonight it could be no more than 50 degrees. It served to remind that this strange and terrible summer was nearing its end. Not for the first time, he wished that Mother Abigail's god or muse or whatever it was had been more in favor of Miami or New Orleans. But that might not have been so great now that he stopped to think about it. High humidity, lots of rain, and lots of bodies. At least Boulder was dry. "They jumped the shit out of me wanting the judge for the law committee," Stu said. "We should have expected that." Franny nodded, and Nick jotted quickly on his pad, "Sure, people will miss Tom and Dana, too. Facts of life."
"Think people will be suspicious, Nick?" Stu asked.
Nick nodded. "They'll wonder if they did go west, for real." They all considered this as Nick took out his butane match and burned the scrap of paper.
"That's tough," Stu said finally.
"You really think so?"
"Sure, he's right," Sue said glumly. "What else have they got to think? That Judge Ferris went to Far Rockaway to ride the monster coaster?"
"We were lucky to get away tonight without a big discussion of what's going on in the West," Fran said. Nick wrote, "Sure were. Next time we'll have to tackle it head-on, I think. That's why I want to postpone another big meeting as long as possible. 3 weeks, maybe. September 15th?
Sue said, "We can hold off that long if Brad gets the power on."
"I think he will," Stu said.
"I'm going home," Sue told them. "Big day tomorrow. Dana's off. I'm going with her as far as Colorado Springs."
"Do you think that's safe, Sue?" Fran asked.
She shrugged.
"Safer for her than for me."
"How did she take it?" Fran asked.
"Well, she's a funny sort of girl. She was a jock in college, you know. Tennis and swimming were her biggies, although she played them all. She went to some small community college down in Georgia, but for the first 2 years she kept on going with her high school boyfriend. He was a big leather jacket type. Me Tarzan, you Jane, so get out in the kitchen and rattle those pots and pans. Then she got dragged along to a couple of female consciousness meetings by her roomie, who was this big liber type."
"And as an upshot, she got to be an even bigger liber than the roomie," Fran guessed.
"First a liber, then a lesbian," Sue said.
Stu stopped as if thunderstruck. Franny looked at him with guarded amusement. "Come on, Splendor in the Grass," she said. "See if you can't fix the hinge on your mouth." Stu shut his mouth with a snap. Sue went on,